Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Pat Steele, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Deanna Snyder. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news in the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news, and then we'll wrap up our broadcast of Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Today we're looking at rain and drizzle this morning, breezy all day long, a high of 51. Winds will be out of the north at 15 to 25 miles per hour. Low tonight, 35 under mostly clear skies. Tomorrow, another windy day on tap with a high of 51. And Thursday's plenty of sunshine, but still kind of cool at a high of 53. Our normal high for this time of year is 57 degrees. Our record high was set back in 2003 at 87. Our record low, 11 degrees in 1881. Sunrise today at 6:55 a.m. And the sun will set this evening at 7:41 p.m. From the front page of Des Moines Register, headlines include breaking down the new funding for education. Interesting story about Deere's Ag Tech, and it's a really great story to share. And Terry Caldwell Johnson, a former Des Moines Public School Board member and activist, has passed away, and she's remembered for her legacy of service. In the Metro and Iowa section, unusual ammo aids in murder conviction. Ex-Fong's co-owner retracts accusation. And an April Fool's post touting new plaza draws a lot of excitement in Historic Valley Junction. So we'll have those stories here in just a bit. And here's Deanna with our very first story.
Thank you, Pat. All right. With the picture on the front page, New York-based technology influencer David Kogan will try his hand at farming this season on a 20-acre tract near Bondurant. So it shows him taking a selfie out in the middle of the field. The headline is, a really great story to share. John Deere's Ag Tech draws online influencer to Iowa to give farming a try. This is from Kevin Baskins of the Des Moines Register. He calls it Kogan's Farm, and David Kogan delights in explaining how he already has selected the corn variety he will plant this spring after careful research and discussion with an agronomist. Yet on a warm day in early March, Kogan is already fretting, sounding every bit like a seasoned farmer. Maybe he should plant earlier than he had originally planned. The weather has been awfully warm after all. Discussion of hybrid seeds choices and planting dates is the kind of conversation that plays out in diners, coffee shops, implement dealerships, and hardware stores across Iowa in the springtime. But Kogan's farm is a little different. It's just 20 acres near Bondurant, a mere fraction of what the U.S. Department of Agriculture says is the average size Iowa farm, which is 359 acres. And Kogan also isn't your typical farmer. He's from Brooklyn, not the one located between Des Moines and Iowa City on Interstate 80, but the one in New York, famous for Coney Island and a bridge bearing its name. With an assist from friends at John Deere, Kogan will try his hand at farming for the first time, attempting to profitably raise a crop and bring it to market, all while sharing the experience on his social media accounts as he progresses through the growing season. Kogan's real job is being a tech influencer on social media, bringing his know-how under the name of the Union or the Unlocker to his 768,000 subscribers on YouTube and 38,700 followers on Instagram. Over about 15 years, he has garnered millions of views for his videos, including a particularly famous one entitled, How to Make the Apple Logo on Your iPhone Light Up Like a MacBook. Excuse me. In announcing his farming venture earlier this spring, Kogan wrote, this small 20-acre piece of land just outside of Des Moines, Iowa, is where for the next 6 months or so I will attempt to till, plant, spray, harvest, and sell corn. This is a project I've been wanting to do for years, honestly. My hope is to show others what farming actually entails. It's complex, hard, and not what most people envision. Oh, and don't worry, there'll be a tech, and it is some of the most impressive out there, honestly. There will be tech. Okay. Commuting from Brooklyn, he will start with field work and planting in April, make a return trip to do some spraying this summer, and then harvest his crop in the fall. Expenses such as farm and equipment rental and seed and chemical costs will be figured in. John Deere will bankroll the project but keep tabs on costs, and Kogan knows he needs a solid yield to make a profit. He told the Des Moines Register he developed his interest in trying to farm from watching British celebrity Jeremy Clarkson's documentary series called Clarkson's Farm, where the TV presenter decides to try his hand at running a farm that he owns in the Cotswolds. For Deere, it is an opportunity to have a well-known technology influencer highlight its oh-wow innovations for monitoring, controlling, and automating agricultural processes to achieve maximum efficiency and yields. I think a lot of people who don't live in Iowa and around rural agriculture think of farmers as, you know, pitchforks and overalls. Farmers are very, very sophisticated businessmen and marketers and technologists. So it just seems that technology is a common link to help people understand how their food is grown, said Franklin Pites, who is technical and innovation PR manager at John Deere. Pites said it is the interest of younger people in technology that provides an avenue to educate them on agriculture and how their food is grown. He said autonomous cars or self-driving cars still haven't really hit the market. However, we've had self-driving tractors for almost a quarter of a century now, he said. Just the adoption of technology in agriculture is tremendous, and we've got a really great story to share, and we're just trying to shed a light on it. The ultimate goal of the project, he said, is to educate people on how complex and difficult farming can be, and how many different decisions growers have to make. It was John Deere that first reached out in 2021, offering Kogan and some other technology influencers an opportunity to come to Iowa, where it has several plants, and Illinois, where Deere is based in the Quad Cities, to try out some of the technology. Kogan drove a huge John Deere combine and was hooked. When the company offered the opportunity, he jumped at the chance to try his hand at farming. I think your average person does not know what it takes to farm. They have an idea in their head of what that is, and it's just not true. I think I would like to just show literally what everyone goes through in farming and the business side of things. I would love to be able to show people, because I think that's also fascinating to me, and how hard it is and how small the margins actually are, he said. Kogan described himself as a competitive person. I would be super, super stoked if I could turn a profit, any profit, he said. That's what I want to do. I want to just, like, make something off the land and get a good yield and not end up just losing money. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Also from the front page, Des Moines Register, Caldwell Johnson, a former Des Moines Public School Board member, is remembered for her legacy of service. Kyle Werner and Samantha Hernandez of the Des Moines Register wrote this article. The Des Moines community lost one of its most prominent activists to cancer on Easter Sunday. Terry Caldwell Johnson was the CEO at Oak Ridge Neighborhood and served on the Des Moines School Board for almost two decades. Caldwell Johnson also worked tirelessly to lift up black and brown communities, and she died Sunday at the age of 68. Reverend Rob Johnson said in a statement, Terry was inspirational, a waymaker, a trendsetter, a mom, and a mentor to so many, her friend. She will be greatly missed. Last year, Caldwell Johnson announced that she had been diagnosed with cancer. In early March, she resigned from the Des Moines School Board, which she had served since 2006 because of her declining health. Over the years, Caldwell Johnson served multiple times as school board chair or vice chair. At the same time, she pulled back from her role at Oak Ridge Neighborhood, a Des Moines nonprofit that provides services such as housing for families in need. She said, it's been my privilege to have been elected to serve on the Des Moines Public School Board over the past 18 years, and my greatest honor is to have served as the board chair. Our district's commitment to student outcomes and policy-focused governance has created a win-win for our district and our current and future students. School district officials were informed she died early Sunday morning. I have had the pleasure of working with several school board members over the years, and Terry Caldwell Johnson was in a class of her own, Des Moines Public Schools Superintendent Ian Roberts said in a news release. Her dignity and grace combined with her determination and will has had a positive impact on countless lives. Des Moines Public Schools is a better place thanks to her nearly 18 years of service to our students, teachers, and families. Caldwell Johnson's time on the board was marked by two national superintendent searches, the COVID-19 pandemic, and work to improve the academic outcomes for students, including Black male students. In total, she has helped oversee three superintendents and one interim superintendent. Most recently, Caldwell Johnson and the board hired Roberts, the first person of color, to oversee Iowa's largest and most diverse school district. At a meeting the night she resigned, current and past school board members spoke about her impact on Des Moines Public Schools and the community. Board member Kim Martirano said at the time, "She has championed for marginalized communities and the empowerment of Black males in our district. She was not afraid to push back when she thought it was needed." In February 2023, she told Iowa lawmakers to leave our public schools alone during the district's State of the Schools address in response to a question about what legislators can do besides increasing funds to help schools. At the height of the pandemic, Des Moines Schools and former Superintendent Tom Ahart came under fire for the board's decision to have students start the 2020-21 school year online. The superintendent later received a written reprimand from the Iowa Board of Educational Examiners for the move. Caldwell Johnson is most remembered at the Des Moines Public Schools for helping to herald in changes. Terry's years of leadership and service to our school district and the entire community are a remarkable legacy and a great memory for us to celebrate and find comfort in at this time. And that's from Jackie Norris, school board chair, and said this in a statement. And she continued, "We have lost someone who was a trailblazer as well as a mentor to so many people, helping everyone around her become a better person in their work." Caldwell Johnson was Oak Ridge's CEO for 20 years. The neighborhood at 14th and Center Streets in Des Moines provides housing and supportive services to 1,000 low-income individuals and families, 60% of whom are immigrants and refugees who speak a variety of languages. Andy McGuire, president of Oak Ridge Neighborhood's board of directors, said in a news release, "She was tireless in her efforts to raise others to achieve their full potential. Her impact as the president and CEO of Oak Ridge Neighborhood for the last 20 years cannot be overstated." Caldwell Johnson made major accomplishments while in Oak Ridge leadership, including a total renovation of the neighborhood's townhomes, a new senior housing facility, numerous campus beautification projects, and the addition of wellness and recreation amenities, according to the release. She also championed numerous education initiatives with Oak Ridge, including an accredited preschool to ensure children are as school-ready as their peers when they enter kindergarten, in-school and out-of-school programs to keep students on track through graduation from high school and in their post-secondary choices, and English language learning, citizenship, job training, and career placement efforts to support adults. McGuire said, "Every day of her life, Terry modeled hard work and a positive, supportive approach. She served others as a mentor, an employer, a volunteer, a community leader, a friend, a wife, and a mother. She was truly an exceptional inspiration to so many." In an interview with the Register earlier this month, McGuire said that Caldwell Johnson was motivated to run for school board in part after the district announced a plan in 2005 to close Edmonds Elementary School, which is located 950th 15th Street. The school serves some of the district's poorest students and was within walking distance of Oak Ridge, a key factor in getting the neighborhood students to school and their finding success in class. After supporters rallied, the district decided to keep the school and in 2012 broke ground on a new building to replace the old one. Caldwell Johnson said in an interview that the district included a video tribute to her. She said, "I ran understanding that kids that are in need and live in impoverished neighborhoods need a voice. And so I decided that I wanted to be the voice for our little brown and black children." McGuire said Caldwell Johnson had been a mentor to her since they first met in 2005 when McGuire ran for lieutenant governor. 10 years ago, Caldwell Johnson encouraged her to volunteer at Oak Ridge Neighborhood to read with the children who live there. She still does every week, now also with her daughter. McGuire said, "She's just infectious. She pulls people together. She gets things moving forward. She's just that kind of person. When Terry calls, people come." As a child of educators and civil rights activists, Caldwell Johnson worked tirelessly for social justice in Central Iowa. Part of that work was as chair of the Directors' Council. It's a group of black CEOs and executive directors working to find solutions to the disparities and inequalities experienced by black people in Polk County. Renee Hardman, president of Lutheran Services in Iowa and the first black woman to serve on the West Des Moines City Council, said they leaned on each other as they broke through barriers. When first elected in 2006, Caldwell Johnson was the only person of color on the school board. Hardman said, "We're very close. As African-American sisters, we talked a lot about our struggles, our triumphs, our successes, our disappointments, and what it meant to show up as a black woman in this community from time to time in spaces where we were alone." Hardman said she saw Caldwell Johnson around 2 weeks ago and knew then it was likely the last time. Hardman said, "I told her that she's loved. I told her that she's left the community a better place. She breathed this air that we all breathe." Prior to her time in Oak Ridge, Caldwell Johnson was the Polk County manager from 1996 to 2003. And the executive director of Metro Waste Authority from 1988 to 1996, and was assistant to the city managers in San Antonio and Ames. Terry lived a life of mission and purpose, serving as chair of the Des Moines School Board, former Polk County manager, an outspoken community activist, and much more. And this is a statement from the Polk County Board of Supervisors. They added, "She touched many lives, and Polk County is forever grateful for her lifetime dedication of service to our community." Caldwell Johnson also served on several nonprofit boards, including the Mid-Iowa Health Foundation, Greater Des Moines Community Foundation, Planned Parenthood, and Spelman College Museum of Fine Art. Her work has been recognized a number of times over the years. She was honored with the state's 2024 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Achievement Award, Christine Wilson Medal for Equality and Justice, and the President's Volunteer Service Lifetime Achievement Award. She was named a 2022 Remarkable Woman by WHO-TV's NextStar Media Group. State Senator Representative Ekayo Abdul-Samad announced earlier this month that Caldwell Johnson had received a certificate of recognition from the Iowa House of Representatives for her long-lasting impact on the students of Des Moines Community School District, the community of Des Moines, and the state of Iowa. From Salina, Kansas, Caldwell Johnson earned a bachelor's in English from Spelman College in Atlanta and a master's of public administration from the University of Kansas. She also completed postgraduate studies at Bucknell University in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Her husband, Vernon, is a retired nonprofit executive. They have two adult children, Bailey and Baxter, both of whom graduated from Lincoln High School. Deanna?
Wow, amazing woman. All right, breaking down new funding for education, $160 million over the next 2 years to raise teacher pay. This is from Stephen Gruber-Miller. How much money will shift from area education agencies to Iowa school districts? How much new money will Iowa schools receive to increase teacher pay? And how much money is the state expected to spend on private school education savings accounts next year? The wide-ranging education law Governor Kim Reynolds signed on March 27th contains the answers to all those questions. The legislation makes changes to AEA funding, provides new state money for schools to increase pay for teachers, and gives K through 12 schools a 2.5% funding increase for the upcoming school year. Here's a breakdown of where the dollars will go. Nearly $90 million will shift from AEAs to Iowa school districts. The new law keeps the bulk of special education funding with the AEAs, while shifting funding for general education services and media services to school districts over 2 years. Statewide, the AEAs took in about $449.7 million in revenue in fiscal year 2024, which ends June 30th. Including a fund balance of $76.9 million at the beginning of the year, the AEAs have control of about $526.5 million, according to an analysis from the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. That money includes state and federal funding and property tax revenue. Beginning in the 2025-26 school year, the AEAs will keep 90% of the state money they currently receive for special education, and school districts will gain control of the remaining 10%. Iowa's school funding formula allocated about $185.3 million to the AEAs for special education funding in fiscal year 2024, but the agencies actually received closer to $155.7 million after lawmakers cut the AEA's budget last year. 10% of that funding amounts to about $18.5 million that would go to school districts to pay for special education services instead of the AEAs. It's not clear whether school districts will choose to spend that money with the AEAs. Federal funding that goes to the agencies is untouched by the new law, about $138.5 million in the current fiscal year. When the law is fully in effect in the 25-26 school year, the AEAs will lose all the money they receive from the state for media services and general education services, amounting to $68 million. The AEAs currently receive about $35.7 million for general education services and $32.3 million for media services, according to an LSA bill analysis. Schools could choose to continue spending that money with the AEAs under a fee-for-service model, but the money is no longer guaranteed. Under this model, the AEAs would be required to charge reasonable fees that are consistent with market rates. Minimum pay for beginning teachers will increase to $47,500 in the coming school year and to $50,000 the following year, up from a minimum of $33,500. And the law sets a minimum salary of $60,000 for teachers with at least 12 years of experience in the coming school year, before raising that minimum to $62,000 the next year. To pay for the salary increases, Iowa will allocate $67.6 million for the coming school year and $96.1 million for the 25-26 school year. In the first year, the $67.6 million includes $27.4 million for beginning teacher salaries, $17.9 million to raise salaries for teachers with 12 years of experience, and $22.4 million to raise pay for other teachers. In the second year, the $96.1 million breaks down to $47.1 million for beginning teachers, $25.8 million for teachers with 12 years of experience, $23.1 million for other teachers. The state will continue providing schools with money to pay the higher teacher salaries in the coming years as part of Iowa's education funding formula. The law includes another $14 million to increase pay for non-salaried school staff, including paraeducators. Unlike the higher pay for teachers, Iowa's state supplemental aid for schools will not automatically include new money for paraeducator pay each year. Instead, lawmakers will have to choose each year how much funding, if any, they will provide. The money for teacher and school staff pay increases will go only to public schools in Iowa, to public schools, not private schools. The law also increases state per pupil aid to schools by 2.5%, an increase of $191 per pupil, bringing total state funding for public K-12 schools to $3.8 billion. That means the state will spend $7,826 per student, up from $7,635 during the current school year. The state also is expected to spend $179.2 million in the coming year on private school education savings accounts. That's an increase of $51.3 million over the $127.9 million that Iowa spent on education savings accounts during the current school year. The Legislative Services Agency expects about 6,100 additional students to use education savings accounts in the upcoming year, which it predicts would bring total enrollment in the program to 22,900 students. In the current school year, 16,757 students used the education savings accounts to pay for expenses at accredited private schools in Iowa. The state approved nearly 19,000 students to receive education savings accounts, but the money returns to the state if it is not spent. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Elsewhere in the main section of the Des Moines Register, Department of Transportation finds a ring and saves a company's celebration. Employees find owners of ring found on highway. Paris Barraza of the Register wrote this article. It's not uncommon to see remnants of a tire or debris on the sides of Iowa interstates. Less common, a ring tucked inside a box. But that's exactly what Zachary Ahrens and Jacob Kammerling discovered on Interstate 80 in March, said Johnny Shanahan, highway maintenance supervisor with the Iowa Department of Transportation. The two highway technician associates are part of the overnight crew in Coralville with the DOT, and they're tasked with removing debris on the shoulders or in ditches along the interstate. Their unique discovery led to the reunion of a ring intended for one employee's 40th anniversary with a Kansas-based company. What does the ring belong, or who does the ring belong to? Shanahan reached out to the owners through the contact information found inside the abandoned FedEx package. He said, "We try to practice really good customer service at the DOT, adding it's well worth their time helping return someone's property." An email popped up in the inbox of Kristen Trupkowski, a talent and organizational effectiveness consultant with IBT Industrial Solutions, saying they had her ring. More specifically, a ring that was intended for an employee's 40th anniversary with the company. Brian Shore, operations support manager, said, "I did not know that it was gone. That was really shocking to me." IBT, headquartered in Kansas, is a distribution company founded 75 years ago. Tracy Biggerstaff, Senior Director of Marketing, said, "Whenever you think about how your Amazon packages get to you, there's a whole crew of people behind that with conveying, delivery, and then the products themselves, we support them. We support the warehouse facility, the drivers, all the moving parts that make our lives on a day-to-day basis comfortable." Yes, and the ring is in perfect condition, too. IBT was built on a family, work-life balance, and community, Biggerstaff said. CEO Jeff Cloud, whose grandfather started the company decades ago, presents these rings to employees who've had a tenure of 40 years, both Biggerstaff and Trupkowski explain. Biggerstaff, in an email, said there are 395 employees with IBT, and that 24% of them have been with IBT for more than 20 years. Shore is part of the nearly 10% of staff with 30 to 40 years at the company. While Trupkowski said IBT would have realized the ring had gone missing and reordered it, these custom-made pieces of jewelry take about 6 to 8 weeks to produce and deliver. That would have meant cutting it real close to having the ring in time for Shore's anniversary. Instead, Iowa DOT's discovery meant no disappointed employees or delayed anniversary ceremonies. Our company, being built on values, our hearts were just overwhelmed with joy whenever we saw other people expressing the same kind of ethics and values that we hold so dearly to ourselves, Biggerstaff said. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. And one more kind of local article on page 4 of the main section. Fire strikes Indianola's National Balloon Museum. This is so unfortunate. This is by Jose Mandiola of Des Moines Register. Just a week before its grand reopening, the National Balloon Museum and U.S. Ballooning Hall of Fame in Indianola was damaged by a fire Friday. Now the museum's reopening is postponed indefinitely, as investigators work to find a cause of the fire and staff create a plan for repairs, said Board President Eric Martins. He said the damage inside is pretty severe. I'd be surprised if we're doing another grand reopening in the next year even. The Indianola Fire Department was dispatched to the museum at 1601 North Jefferson Way at around 8:10 a.m. for a fire alarm. Captain Thad White said, and a worker said that she had smelled smoke and saw smoke over the museum. Martins said the fire was contained to the front corridor and gift shop, but there is smoke and water damage throughout the building. Unfortunately, they did not have a sprinkler system in the building, White said. I think if they had a sprinkler system, it would have kept the smoke damage to a minimum. There were no injuries. As of Friday afternoon, officials were still investigating what caused the fire. The museum has been closed over the winter as it underwent a remodel, including new exhibits that showcase the history and evolution of hot air balloons, a new and bigger children's area, and a refreshed interior. It was set to debut the changes during the grand reopening on April 6th. Built in 1988, the museum's colorful blue, white, and yellow design was made to resemble two inverted balloons. The museum showcases more than 200 years of ballooning and hosts 10,000 visitors a year, according to its website. Martin said the board spent about $15,000 on the renovations to create a fresh new look and a new place people hadn't been to before. While they haven't been inside yet, museum staff don't believe anything irreplaceable was damaged in the fire. But, he said, the work that they spent about a year doing is now moot. We're extremely heartbroken, he said. We are really excited about this reopening. Pat.
Thank you, Dan. That's tough. From the Metro and Iowa section, our top story here is unusual ammo, AIDS, and murder conviction. Math adds up for jury in slaying of Des Moines man. William Morse of the Register wrote this article. A Des Moines man found shot to death in October 2021 was murdered by the man he was meeting to purchase drugs, a Polk County jury found Friday. Calvin Klein, age 21, was killed early October 22, 2021. Police responded to reports of gunshots outside a Hall Avenue apartment building, found him slumped behind the wheel of a car with numerous wounds, and he was declared dead at the scene. He left behind a wife and two children. Police charged Darren Diggs, age 29, with first-degree murder in Klein's death. Diggs, a resident in the nearby building, was known to sell controlled substances, according to investigators, and Klein, before his death, was addicted to the anti-anxiety medication Xanax. Phone records showed he made several calls to Diggs' phone shortly before the 5:30 a.m. shooting. During Diggs' trial, which began Monday, prosecutors drew additional connections between Diggs and the shooting. Video footage from the apartment building showed a man leaving and re-entering the building about the time of the shooting, wearing a distinctive sweatshirt matching one found in Diggs' apartment. Police also found a pistol in the apartment that ballistics experts matched the spent shell casings found at the scene and a half-empty box of the same uncommon brand of ammunition. Between the box, several magazines of ammunition, and the shots fired at the scene, investigators were able to account for all 50 rounds that came in the box. Diggs had one of those magazines, as well as Xanax pills, on his person when he was arrested. During the ensuing interrogation, police said he gave inconsistent answers about whether and why he'd left the building that morning and whether he'd had his gun at the time. At one point, officers asked if they could swab Diggs' hands for gunshot residue, then left him alone in the interview room with a bottle of water. Video footage appeared to show Diggs attempting to surreptitiously wash his hands with the water after they left. Investigators never determined a motive for the shooting, but prosecutor Jackie Livingston told jurors Thursday they had all they needed to find Diggs guilty. Nobody knows what happened in that car, she said during closing arguments. We don't know what made Mr. D decide to use that gun, but we know that he did, and he did so more than once. Diggs did not testify or offer any witnesses in his defense. His attorneys argued that prosecutors couldn't prove Diggs was the shooter. Defense attorney Wendy Samuelson said in the closing argument, identity is an element the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and the state has failed to do that. The jury received the case at noon Thursday and returned their verdict of guilty just after noon on Friday. Diggs will be sentenced at a later date. Under Iowa law, the mandatory sentence for first-degree murder is life in prison without parole. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. April Fool's post touting New Plaza draws excitement. Not everyone thought Historic Valley Junction's announcement was a joke. This is from Paris Baratza, the Des Moines Register. As part of an April Fool's Day joke, Historic Valley Junction revealed grand plans to transform its downtown into a plaza for pedestrians, improving walkability and offering features such as outdoor dining. But the detailed plans posted to Facebook on April 1st, paired with renderings of this fake pedestrian plaza, have left a few social media users eager for the idea and others concerned. The joke is all the better because it seems within the realm of possibility as opposed to being outlandish, said Steve Frevert, Historic Valley Junction Foundation executive director, who confirmed to the Register that the post was an April Fool's Day joke. Valley Junction has done April Fool's Day posts in previous years, including announcing the West Des Moines dining and shopping destination would rebrand itself as the West Village, Frevert said, as a play on Des Moines' East Village. So what does Historic Valley Junction's April Fool's Day post say? Valley Junction announced in the social media post that it was unveiling plans for a spectacular pedestrian plaza with construction slated for May 2025. The eagerly anticipated Valley Junction Promenade would offer additional bicycle store racks, walkable areas for pedestrians free from vehicular traffic, additional lampposts and lighting installations, infrastructure to support events, food vendors, and farmers market merchants, new benches and seating, more landscape features, dedicated areas for outdoor patios. As part of these plans, 5th Street would permanently be closed in the 100 to 200 blocks along with Railroad Place, Valley Junction revealed. An earlier version of the social media post stated this was part of an April Fool's Day joke, though Frevert decided that that should be removed to keep the joke going a bit longer. So what are some people saying about the fake plans for Historic Valley Junction Promenade? Some Facebook users support the idea, though several had concerns over how these plans would affect already limited parking at Valley Junction. I've been to a couple of pedestrian malls on the East Coast, said a Facebook user by the name of Shannon Dario. It is really nice. If shade is taken into consideration and parking, if people have to walk far, it can hurt a mall like that. This could really be fun. I hope that the rear entrance will be taken into consideration for upgrades into businesses from parking lots. Can we see the location for planned parking? Said a Facebook commenter named Stasia Kuliver-Veritzelar. If there is not adequate and easily accessible parking near this, it will significantly hurt these small businesses. I love the idea of this. It's very popular in Europe. However, in my experience, where they were located, there was plenty of parking availability as well as accessible mass transit stops for buses and trains. Another commenter by the name of Stephanie Bernard said, "Nice to see plans for more seating." The post had almost 300 reactions and 130 comments as of noon Monday. So, will Valley Junction pursue these plans in the future? Some of the amenities mentioned in the post could enhance the pedestrian experience, and so maybe some of that will come true in the future. Frevert said the city of West Des Moines, they put a lot of investment into the infrastructure here in Valley Junction, and certainly we think that it will continue as the needs arise, he said.
Thank you, Deanna. Continuing with the Metro and Iowa section, jury finds officer city liable in death caused by crash during police chase and awards $4.25 million. William Morse wrote this article. In the hospital room where Augustine Gus Mormon lay dying, his father made a promise, "I will find out what happened." More than 3 years later, Dan Mormon knows what happened. So does the Delaware County jury. Gus Mormon, age 31 of Colesburg, died in January 2021, more than a month after being thrown from his motorcycle during a high-speed chase with police. His parents, Dan and Sandy, sued the officer who pursued him, Manchester Police Lieutenant Jim Wessels, and the city for his death. On March 22nd, the jury found Wessels and Manchester liable and awarded Mormon's parents $4.25 million in damages. They say the verdict gives them a greater sense of closure, even as they continue grieving their son. Their attorney, Dave O'Brien, said the Mormons shouldn't have had to sue to hold the officer accountable for what he believes was clearly illegal behavior. The Register reached out to attorneys for Wessels and Manchester for comment, but they did not immediately respond. In court filings, defense attorney argued Wessels' actions were not legally reckless and that he was entitled under Iowa law to immunity for his conduct as a law enforcement officer responding to an emergency. Who was Gus Mormon? In an interview, Mormon's parents remembered him as a farm kid with a talent for driving heavy equipment who was lucky in everything he did, from fishing to cards to looking for arrowheads. When he was 25, his luck took a turn for the worse as he began showing symptoms of what was eventually diagnosed as schizophrenia, his parents said. Despite various treatments, his condition worsened. In the months leading up to his death, there were more than a dozen interactions with police, including several times when his parents had to call for help because he was out of control. On December 10, 2020, despite his license being barred, he was out riding his beloved motorcycle when a police officer tried to pull him over. Instead, Gus Mormon took off and sped toward Manchester. As he laid out in court filings, several officers from other agencies joined the chase, but as they neared the city, most of them called it off. Mormon's only crime, aside from eluding, was driving while barred, and they knew his identity. Wessels, though, continued the chase. O'Brien said Wessels was driving more than 100 miles per hour when he caught up with Mormon, who was driving closer to 60, and swerved to avoid him. The two vehicles made contact twice, once on each side of Wessels' squad car, and the second impact sent Mormon careening out of control into a ditch and through a fence, his bike eventually coming to rest more than 100 feet from the road. Mormon suffered major spinal injuries, and although he regained consciousness, he remained largely paralyzed and unable to breathe without a ventilator. He eventually chose to discontinue the ventilator, and on January 15th, 36 days after the crash, he died with his parents beside him. Sandy Mormon, his mom said, "We sat beside his bed for 35 hours. It's pretty hard for a parent to watch their son die." Why did the officer continue the pursuit? The Mormons agree their son should have stopped and that police had grounds to arrest him. But once it was clear he wasn't stopping, there was no point in continuing to chase him, his parents say. "We know that's the right thing for Gus to have stopped. But why did Wessels chase as far as he could, get ahead of everybody else, and everybody else called the pursuit off, and he thought he was going to do what?" Dan Mormon asked. "What was he going to do when he caught up with him?" Normal police tactics with speeding vehicles, such as using stop sticks or controlled crashes to stop the other driver, are even more unsafe to use against motorcyclists, O'Brien said. "So there's just no purpose of it, and I think the jury found that." The jury awarded the couple $250,000 for the son's injuries and $2 million each for the loss of their son. The jury also separately awarded $10,000 in punitive damages, finding that Wessels' actions showed a willful, wanton, and reckless disregard for the rights or safety of another. "The most important thing for the family," his parents say, "is that they learned the truth of what happened." Sandy Mormon said, "I feel a little bit more relieved, a little bit more of a closure, but it still feels like you're never going to be healed. You're going to be empty. So it's good that we got to go and tell our story. I feel really good about that." And they listened, and we told the honest truth. Deanna.
Thank you, Pat. All right, what's next for George the Chili King after the landmark signs removal? This is from Addison Lathers of the Des Moines Register. George the Chili King Carrados Jr. died in 2019. Now the sign that made his nickname a Des Moines landmark is gone too. Closed since the death of Carrados, The restaurant just east of the busy intersection of Hickman and Merle Hay Road lost its sign Thursday afternoon as a crew used a crane to take down the neon artifact. Des Moines photographer Andy Lyons caught the moment and said the workers told him a collector had bought it. It's not clear what will happen to the building itself. There's no city record of anyone applying for a demolition permit. According to the Polk County Assessor, the building and land is still in the name of Caritos and his wife, Karen. She could not be reached Friday for comment. George Caritos Sr. opened George the Chili King at 5722 Hickman Road in 1952. He ran the diner with his son, serving coney dogs, pork tenderloins, and, of course, chili. The legacy came to a close when the younger Caritos died at the age of 86 after undergoing treatment for cancer. It has sat vacant since shortly after Caritos' death and eventually ended up on the Des Moines Heritage Trust's list of historic buildings at risk of demolition. Last remodeled in 1983, the building has retained much of its original charm and look. The Polk County Assessor values the property at $104,000 and lists the restaurant's condition as normal. The restaurant was once featured on Guy Fieri's Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. The best-selling author Bill Bryson, a Des Moines native, wrote about it in its last gastric impact in his memoir, The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid. Whatever becomes of it, George the Chili King will live on in the memories of generations of Des Moines residents. This place is near and dear to a lot of people, Lyons said. I grew up there. And it still has the little drive-in places in the back where you could pull up your car and order your chili. Pat, back to you.
Yeah, great historic place there in Des Moines. Our final Metro and Iowa story is ex-Fong's co-owner retracts accusations, claimed retaliation for objecting to decisions. Chris Higgins of the Register wrote this article. A former Fong's Pizza co-owner who accused business partners of firing her without cause has retracted her accusations. Gwen Page, who previously was involved with the Fong's brand as co-owner and manager and has said she co-founded the Fusion Pizza restaurant, issued a news release in March 2021 accusing corporate directors including Dan Massoth, Andy Massoth, and Jeffrey Bruning of retaliation against her after she objected to alleged questionable business practices and filed a lawsuit to guarantee her financial position. Now Page has fully retracted the March 2021 release. In a statement issued Friday, Page said, I retract and withdraw the statements I made in the press release dated March 2021 regarding Dan Massoth, Andy Massoth, and Jeffrey Bruning. We have mutually reached a final settlement of all disputes between the parties and wish each other the best in our future endeavors. The terms of the final settlement were not disclosed. Complex, overlapping legal action between Page and Fong's corporate directors and its corporate entities was ongoing for 3 years. Several claims in the case, including Page's, were dismissed last fall after the downtown Fong's corporate entity agreed to buy out her shares in the company for $770,000, according to court documents. Claims from the defendants that Page defamed them with false statements in the news and on social media continued until the Friday retraction. The original Fong's Pizza in downtown Des Moines opened in 2009 inside what was once the oldest Chinese restaurant in the city. The Fusion menu, which has attracted national attention, feature items like Crab Rangoon Pizza and Southside Pizza with Graziano Sausage. A Fruit Loops Pizza went viral in 2021. The downtown location is the only Fong's Pizza remaining after locations in Cedar Rapids, Ankeny, and the Drake neighborhood closed in recent years. Page now owns Whatcha Smoking Barbecue and Brew, and that's in Luther, Iowa. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. On page 5 of the main section, crews rush to build temporary channel. The route for essential ships is needed in this Baltimore port. This is from John Bacon of USA Today. Nearly 1 week after a container ship's catastrophic crash into a Baltimore bridge, authorities were preparing to establish a temporary alternate channel to allow commercially essential ships to navigate through one of the nation's busiest ports. Coast Guard Captain David O'Connell said the 11-foot-deep temporary route will be marked with lights and represent part of a phased approach to opening the main channel. A 2,000-yard safety zone remains in effect around the Francis Scott Key Bridge site to protect salvage workers, ships, and the marine environment, according to the Unified Command representing multiple agencies and led by O'Connell. O'Connell said this will mark an important first step along the road to reopening the Port of Baltimore. The alternate route will allow some marine traffic in Baltimore, he said. No ships or people will be permitted to enter the safety zone without obtaining permission from the port. Video released by responders showed Coast Guard officials dropping buoys into the water near the site of the collision. The cargo ship Dolly, which weighs 95,000 tons when empty, was loaded with thousands of containers when it rammed the Key Bridge on Tuesday. The crew issued a mayday moments before the collision, allowing authorities to halt traffic before the bridge collapsed into the Patapsco River. However, six workers patching potholes on the bridge were killed. Two bodies have been recovered. Four others are believed trapped underwater in the tangle of steel and concrete. Authorities are scrambling to reopen the Port of Baltimore, blocked by the crumbled 1.6-mile-long bridge and the damaged but apparently seaworthy Dolly. The port handles more cars, heavy trucks, and agricultural equipment than any port inside the country, Maryland Governor Wes Moore said. He provided no timeline on clearing out the massive debris. He said, "We have a ship that is nearly the size of the Eiffel Tower that is now stuck within the channel that has the Key Bridge sitting on top of it," Moore said in the CNN's State of the Union. The first major section of debris, a piece weighing 200 tons, was removed late Sunday by crane, but thousands of tons of debris remain in the river and atop the ship, said Moore. Authorities are still devising a plan for removing it, he said. Coast Guard Rear Admiral Shannon Gilreath told reporters that teams from the Coast Guard, the U.S. Navy's salvage arm, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said the debris from the Patapsco River's deep draft shipping channel would have to be removed before the Dolly could be removed. The Biden administration released $60 million in initial emergency aid on the Thursday to assist in cleaning up the bridge debris and reopening the port, which has been closed since Tuesday, leaving in limbo the jobs of some 15,000 people who rely on its daily operations. Federal officials have told Maryland lawmakers the final cost of rebuilding the bridge could soar to at least $2 billion, Roll Call reported, citing a source familiar with the discussions. President Joe Biden has pledged that the federal government will cover the cost, but that will depend on passage of legislation authorizing the funds by both the Republican-led House of Representatives and Democratic-led Senate. The divided Congress has been repeatedly riven by partisan battles over funding, with hardline Republicans often at odds, even with the members of their own party. Moore, a Democrat, said Republicans should be willing to approve the funding for the sake of not just the city of Baltimore, but for the national economy. The reason that we need people to move in a bipartisan basis is not because we need you to do Maryland a favor, said Moore on CNN Sunday. We need to make sure that we're actually moving quickly to get the American economy going again, because the Port of Baltimore is instrumental in our larger economic growth. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg expressed optimism on Sunday that Congress would approve the funds necessary for the cleanup and rebuild, noting that the divided legislative body had passed Biden's $1 trillion infrastructure package in 2021. Buttigieg said, "If there's anything left in this country that is more bipartisan than infrastructure, it should be emergency response. This is both, and I hope that Congress will be willing if and when we turn to them." Biden was expected to visit the bridge collapse, the site, this week. Searchers on Wednesday recovered the bodies of Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, age 35, and Dorlian Roniel Castillo Cabrera, age 36, from a pickup submerged in 25 feet of water. The search for the other victims was delayed because of treacherous conditions of the wreckage. The Reverend Akeo Walker had held a mass in Spanish at Sacred Heart of Jesus about 5 miles up the Patapsco River from the collapse, the Associated Press reported. The workers weren't parishioners there, but Walker said he reached out to the families because the Latino community in Baltimore is large and closely connected. Walker told the AP he hopes their sacrifice encourages people to embrace migrant workers seeking better lives for themselves and their communities. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Elsewhere in the main section of the paper, judge seems receptive to Trump documents claim. Andrew Gutzwart of Reuters wrote this article. A federal judge overseeing the criminal case that accuses Donald Trump of mishandling classified documents has signaled an openness to the former president's defense claims and a sign that prosecutors might face a difficult road ahead. U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon, who was nominated to the bench by Trump, has asked Trump and prosecutors to propose jury instructions based on two legal scenarios that favor a claim from Trump that national security lawyers said have little relevance to the charges. Trump and special counsel Jack Smith, who brought the case, face a Tuesday deadline to respond to the judge's order. The dispute is another instance of Cannon lending credence to Trump's legal arguments about highly sensitive records taken to his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida when he left the White House in 2021. While Trump has clashed with judges in many of his legal cases, Cannon has been receptive to his defense in ways that could alter the course of the documents case. Brandon Van Grack, a former Justice Department national security official, said, "You have a court who is more favorable to the views of one party versus the other, and you're seeing orders and decisions that are reflective of that." Trump has pleaded not guilty to charges accusing him of knowingly retaining secret records related to U.S. national defense and obstructing efforts by the U.S. government to retrieve them. The prosecution is one of four facing Trump as he seeks to unseat Democrat Joe Biden in the November 5th presidential election. Trump has cast the cases as part of a politically motivated effort to damage his campaign. At issue in Cannon's recent order is Trump's claim that he treated the documents as personal under a 1978 law that allows former presidents to keep records that have no connection to their official responsibilities. Trump's lawyers argue his decision to keep the records shows that he deemed them to be his personal property. Prosecutors have said the documents could not be construed as personal because they relate to U.S. intelligence and military matters. The records law could not authorize Trump to keep classified papers, they said. Cannon expressed skepticism at a March 14th court hearing that Trump's claim requires the charges to be tossed out, but said it may prove forceful at a future trial. She later ordered dueling sets of proposed jury instructions, assuming either that the government would have to prove the records belong to the government or that neither the judge nor the jury could question Trump's stance that they are personal. Kel McClanahan, a national security lawyer who has represented members of the U.S. intelligence community, said of the competing scenarios, "Both of them are completely irrelevant, and both actually favor the defendant." Mark Zaid, a defense lawyer who has worked on cases involving classified information, said he is unaware of an instance where a document produced by a federal agency was declared a personal record by a president. A trial date remains uncertain. Cannon has not yet ruled on competing proposals from Trump and prosecutors to delay the currently scheduled May 20th trial until later this summer. Cannon has escaped the ire that Trump has directed the judges overseeing his other legal cases, whom he has frequently accused of bias and criticized in personal terms.